And I don't blame him a bit. But the idea that he can assess her attributes by looking is, you know, I always wish that he would come up to her and she would smile and not have her teeth or something. You know, or say, "Hi, what's your sign?" You know? But she turns out to be very witty, and they engage in a battle of wits where they have puns and all this stuff. But it turns out that he is Romeo and Montague. And she's bemoaning as she sticks her head out her window of her balcony and says, "Why do you have to be Romeo? Why aren't you? Why can't you be something else? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet." Well, there's your obstacle. Here's your rendezvous. People think that courtly love is non-sexual, it's platonic. No, I'm afraid that's wrong. It's entirely focused on the next time they get together. So here, they've spent the night together. Your parents will tell you what that means later. And she is so in love that she doesn't want him to go, and so you have what's called the abode, which is the morning song. And they hear the lark of morning heralding the day. And she says, "No, it's not the lark, it's the nightingale." Well, he knows if he gets caught, he's going to get killed. He says, "It's not the nightingale, it's the lark." And he goes. Now, the problem is, of course, the plot thickens. She is thought to be dead. The messenger gets trapped, doesn't get to Romeo. He goes to the tomb to mourn the loss of his beloved Juliet, who's not really dead. She's just drugged. He thinks he really is. He takes poison, and he dies. And she wakes up, sees he's dead, sticks a dagger in her chest, and she's dead. And so you have the end of the play. Now, According to Abdu'l-Bahá, none of these paradigms, which are really events, they're not really processes, they're not really relationships, none of these is authentic love. And I'm not going to read this quote because you're all familiar with it, I know. But he says in two passages in his discussion of love and some answered questions that this kind of thing we call love does exist. It's simply not love, not by itself. Today you will see two souls apparently in close friendship. Tomorrow this may be changed. Yesterday they were ready to die for one another. Today they shun one another's society. This isn't love. It is the yielding of the hearts to the accidents of life. Now, what we need to realize then, as Baha'u'llah discusses in Seven Valleys and elsewhere, is that love is a process. And this is where we go back to our thesis. I wish to be known, therefore I brought creation into being that I might be known, but by known in a particular way. Again, remember, you can't coerce someone to learn something. You can't coerce someone to love you. What you can do is provide opportunity. So you need time, and you need stages of development or progress. That's the ladder of love. It's from Plato's Symposium. If we go back down, we can imagine that these are equivalent to the seven valleys of Baha'u'llah, where you search for the beloved, you catch a scent of the friend or the beloved in the mystical tradition, and so you have this blinding attraction, this affection, this infatuation. And then you want to know, if you have any sense, what it is you're attracted to. Because if you're not in a condition of health, you could be attracted to someone who's not good for you. Just as if you're in training as an athlete, you will be automatically attracted to foods that are nourishing and good for you. But if you're unhealthy, you'll be attracted to precisely what's bad for you. That's why Baha'u'llah has the law of parental consent. All right? Because sometimes we can tell when you're not healthy, and we know that you're making a bad choice. But you don't see it. But if you have any sense, you'll extricate yourself from the claws of the eagle of love long enough to assess what it is you're attracted to see if it's worthy, healthy, and then you'll proceed through the other stages. Or in Christian and Islamic mysticism, you also have these same kind of ascending stages that are described by any number of mystics in the medieval period and other periods as well, of ever more intensive experience of nearness to the divine. Usually that have an index of some physical experience. I've listed these, these are just arbitrary that I listed, but you begin, say, with the search for the beloved. You feel attracted to the beloved. You found a scent of the beloved, to use Sufi terms. You study the beloved to see what it is you're attracted to. You achieve some state of understanding of the beloved and why you're attracted. Or in the case of another person, what qualities of that person remind you of the beloved. And you then attain a sense of something more important than intellectual comprehension of that attraction, but a sense of I've satisfied my intellectual curiosity, and you feel a union with that. Again, you compare this very importantly with your progress in the faith as you go through the various stages of love for the faith. Love the characteristics of the beloved in others, then love the others for themselves. Union with others, love the ultimate source of all attributes, and then ultimately, as it's variably described in the Hidden Word, in the Seven Valleys and other mystical writings, the state of fana, or total selflessness, true poverty and absolute nothingness. The loss of self, which is really a fulfillment of self. Now, how are we doing so far? Well, our planet, according to most geophysicists, is 5.9 billion years old. And according to the writings, we are in the midst of reaching maturation. So we did the geophysical part. We did the rocks. We got nice rocks. We've got diamonds and all kinds of really pretty rubies and things. Plants, exotic plants. Animals we're not doing real well with, we're losing a lot of them, but the ones we've got are very nice. I particularly like the cows. Human physical evolution, we did that, been there, done that. Intellectual evolution, we're very smart. Einstein proved that, and unfortunately he was later disproven, but by even more smart people. And we have human spiritual evolution, which is in progress. So we're waiting for the lesser piece. We're hoping that or at least I'm hoping I'll be able to see it. I've been waiting for it since the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I thought would do it for sure. Didn't do it. Well, let's analyze these stages on a collective level. Attraction. Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá state that inherent in our creation is the love of reality. We are inherently attracted to stuff. Why? Because, very simply, all stuff reflects the attributes of God. That's why we're attracted to it. So sometimes that attraction is perverted or distorted and so on, but that's what attracts us to anything that attracts us, ultimately, because it's inherent. Look at look at the computer. Here, let me go to the previous one here. God, last sentence, God has created or deposited this love of reality in man. We love reality inherently. In other words, it's not a choice we have. We're created that way. And we love it, as I said, because everything reminds us of that from which we emanated as a breath of spirit from God. Stage two, understanding our knowledge. notice the claws of the eagle of love. Love in the sense that Derougemont is describing it does exist. You do get struck down by it. These attractions occur. They're not imagined. But what you do with them then? Well, if it's a healthy love, you investigate it, and you, by escaping from the claws of the eagle of love, that doesn't make love sound like a really sweet, nice thing, does it? Well, it requires free will to do that. It's not just going to happen. This is why the law of chastity is so important. You know, once you're enmeshed in a physical relationship, you can't step back and say, well, let me see what objectively I feel about this. Yeah, you're going to be very objective. So free will is very important. And to illustrate this, I chose a poem by John Donne called Batter My Heart. And it's an interesting poem because the speaker, which is not really John Donne, but a character he creates. John Donne is a very smart guy. This is a very ironic poem. And he's saying, God, I try. I love you, I really do. But I am so ensnared by attraction to things antithetical to you, I can't seem to exert enough free will. So batter my heart. He compares himself to a walled city. Batter my heart, three-person God, for you is yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like a usurped town, to another do, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason your viceroy in me should defend, but is captive and proves weak or untrue. So you have these images of great power, batter my overthrow me, break, blow, burn, make me new, divorce me, imprison me, ravish me. Great irony there. I'll be chaste if you ravish me. So he's in effect asking God to take over. His own duty. John Donne would be pleased at your applause. One of the more intriguing books I came across in my research in doing this book, which includes discussions of particle physics, astrophysics, evolution, all kinds of other proofs and problems and so on, is a book called The Illusion of Free Will. It was published last year by a professor at Harvard, but by MIT Press. Which should tell you something right there. But what's interesting is what Wegener says is that, and if any of you are students of his, I'm sorry, but it's not a very good book. He says that as a particle physicist, he can hardly accept the existence of metaphysical reality, let alone metaphysical reality having an influence on physical reality. Because then, when Wilczek is splitting a quark, he'd have to say, I sure hope the people at the Deepa Chopra seminar aren't praying for this because it could affect the outcome. You know? How would you know as a physicist if metaphysical influences can affect physical events? How would you know that your results are correct? You know, so what he says is, we can't possibly have will, I mean, in the sense of a metaphysical force that actually does stuff, because it would have to be a metaphysical force and it would have to exert its influence on physical reality. So what he says is we have an authorship emotion. In other words, it's a post-hoc event or emotion that occurs when we, you know, I sure felt like I did that, you know, but it was just, I felt that emotion that I did it right after that thing moved, and it was, I had the sensation of doing it, but I didn't cause it. So what I realized is that Wegener could not possibly have written the book, you know, because he would have had to, well, let's put it this way. What I came up with was the Wegener Profitability Investment Strategy, whereby if we all gather tomorrow and go down to MIT Press, we can claim our fair share of the royalties from the book because we have the emotion that we wrote the book. I'm going to donate my portion to a chair, not a chair, a professorial chair, but a rocking chair for postmodernist theorists in their old postmodernist home where they rock on the front porch because they have deconstructed themselves and don't think they exist anymore. And one of them will stand up and say, "I rock, therefore I am." Well, Baha'u'llah says that we not only have free will, we not only have a classroom that is full of opportunities, but we are accountable for this, each of us, for recognizing what it is that we're supposed to do, namely to know and to love God. Now, how can that be? Well, we're missing one ingredient, and that is you can have the capacity to do this and to understand this. You can be in a classroom replete with evidence of creator and design, but you still need someone more intelligent than you are to prime you, to get you started. And this, of course, is true in any traditional classroom situation, and it's true for humanity as a whole. And so we have the process for bringing about guidance in our love of God. And the problem is the gap. And I'm not, I know that's blue denim, but I don't mean the store here. The problem is that we need a means by which the Holy Spirit can traverse that gap between metaphysical reality and us in physical reality. And the way in which that is done is the process between the command, kun, be, and it is. You remember when Abdu'l-Bahá was placing the cornerstone at the temple in Wilmette, he said the temple is already built, which meant he could see the end and the beginning, and he knew that in effect there was sufficient will and determination that he could, he knew that it, in effect it was done. Well, in one sense, we're talking about, but then we had 40 years of building it to put it in effect. Well, we're talking about what happens in between. So we begin with the divine will or wish to be known, going back to the hidden treasure again. We have the creation of an ever-advancing civilization, not people in one static place with their Dyson vacuum cleaners, but in process, because the Baha'i definition of salvation is not a certain point of attainment. It is being in motion, in forward motion. So anywhere you go from where you are that's forward is salvation. And so you need a way of getting that power to civilization. And of course, the way you do that is with the intermediary of translating that into that. Replicating, as Christ said, "Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven." So you have this top-down view of how do we make this earth resemble the heavenly realm and its attributes. And you do that with the intermediary, and of course the intermediary is a means by which the Holy Spirit is transmuted and translated into terms we can understand. And so you need a human form with whom we can converse and understand, because if it just suddenly a blast of some sort occurred and so on, we couldn't intuit this information. And so, in crucial times, you need two of these. And if you squint your eyes, you'll see that that's what Abdu'l-Bahá did when he designed the ring symbol. He shows a top-down view of replicating perfection, Baha, as it is in heaven on earth by means of the intermediary of the Holy Spirit descending through the manifestation. However, and this is very important, this is something you might not have thought of before, that's a subordinate relationship, and it's verified by this quote that you're all familiar with. Know thou that the kingdom is the real world, and this nether place is only its shadow stretching out. A shadow hath no life of its own. Its existence is only a fantasy and nothing more. It is but images reflected in water and seeming as pictures to the eye. So this dust heap, this is nothing, this world, and so on. So you have that, but then you have the antithesis of it. And that is, if you'll notice on the corners of the shrine at the Bab, the symbol is arranged in a counterpoint relationship, so that it's not so much one above the other, but you have them corresponding to each other. Now listen carefully, because this gets interesting. Here's the quote that supports that view. The spiritual world is like unto the phenomenal world. They are the exact counterpart of each other. Whatever objects appear in this world of existence are the outer pictures of the world of heaven. Imagine that. That means every single attribute or combination of attributes that can exist in spiritual reality must necessarily have an expression in physical reality. Which means what? Physical reality has to be infinite. Now imagine that's infinity. Let me go back and do it again for you. Here we are in the realm of the spirit. It's going all the way past the screen over there and all the way that way for infinity and that way and that way and every other way. It's infinite. It's infinite. But if physical reality is a counterpart relationship, it's got to be infinite too. It's like the outer garment of the physical world, the visible aspect of spiritual reality, not a separate reality. Now, if you think of the fact that we are souls right now, we're really breaking the laws of all modern contemporary physicists' theories right now by speaking soul to soul. All right? Because you're willfully listening, I hope, and I'm willfully speaking, I think. And all kinds of complex things have to go through the intermediary by which this comes into speech, to sound, goes through these speakers sometimes, and reaches your ears. And so we are souls populating the spiritual world, but we can't see that realm. It's concealed from us. So long as we have an associative relationship through the brain with physical reality, we feel like we're physical, we feel like our thinking is right here. Though Baha'u'llah says the mind, the conscious mind, associates with the brain, but is not in the brain or of the brain any more than the soul, even though it associates with the body, is dependent on the body. And so, if you will, we are still spiritual souls operating in the guise of a physical situation, and so we relate to each other as best we can in this, but veiled from the fact that in the twinkling of an eye, that physical reality, once someone hits you with an Escalade of death, the Hyundai of death, you suddenly, as Baha'u'llah says, in the twinkling of an eye, this whole illusion of your being physical is shattered and you are made aware. There's no longer an associative relationship. So, here's where it gets even more interesting. So pay attention again. I mean, not that you haven't been, you're doing great. Three stages of assistance before incarnation, during incarnation, after incarnation. The manifestations are assisting us before they're incarnate. The prophets, unlike us, are pre-existent. The soul of Christ existed in the spiritual world before his birth in this world. We cannot imagine what that world is like, so words are inadequate to picture his state of being. Pre-existent knowledge. By the one true God, we read the tablet ere it was revealed, while you were yet unaware, and we had perfect knowledge of the book when you were yet unborn. They choose where they're going to become manifest. The primary reason why the Bab and Baha'u'llah chose to appear in Persia, and you Persians might not want to read this. It's not good. We'll skip over that. They choose the persona through which they will become manifest. The dissolution of the tabernacle, wherein the soul of the manifestation of God had chosen temporarily to abide. He chose not only to do this, but, and this is my personal opinion, totally personal speculation, it may be one of the meanings of the Suri Hekel. The construction of the physical vehicle through which he's about to operate. I don't think that's all it means. It's a very complex work, but it's interesting to think about. Stage two, during incarnation. Well, we don't need to spend a lot of time on that. We're all familiar with that. He brings new laws. His own person exemplifies his own revelation. But this is another important thing that many Baha'is are not keenly aware of, and that is, from the beginning, that holy reality is conscious of the secrets of existence, and from the age of childhood, signs of a greatness appear and are visible in him. Therefore, how can it be that all these bounties and perfections, he should have no consciousness? Or to put it, this again, the person of the manifestation is one of the proofs of his station. Very important. In other words, their manifestations before they come, they are aware they're going to do it, they're aware when they're here of who they are. One explanation of their omniscience. Now, this is interesting. They are omniscient. Since the sanctified realities, the supreme manifestations of God, surround the essence and qualities of the creatures, transcend and contain existing realities, and understand all things, therefore, their knowledge is divine knowledge and not acquired. That is to say, it is a holy bounty. It is divine revelation. They are omnipotent at will. As Baha'u'llah says in page 32 of Epistle of the Son of the Wolf, I think it is, that don't talk about the miracles we performed. It's not the kind of proof we need to utilize, nor we want. Why? If the prophet said, I am going to be, my name is going to be Baha'u'llah, I will appear in Tehran in the year so-and-so, what proof of understanding would be adduced by someone discovering the prophet? None. So they're concealed. During their lifetimes, they are concealed. So the only ones who will find them are those who are attuned to what it is they're looking for. Here's another really mind-boggling thing. The creativity of the prophet. We're used to speaking of the prophet as the mouthpiece of God, which of course in one sense he is. But it is clear in the writings that the prophet plays an artistic or creative role, not only in his language, but in everything else he does. Not ours, the living witness of the all-subduing potency of his faith, to question for a moment, and however dark the misery that enshrouds the world, the ability of Baha'u'llah to forge with the hammer of his will, and through the fire of tribulation upon the anvil of this travailing age, and in the particular shape his mind has envisioned, these scattered and mutually destructive fragments into which a perverse world has fallen, into one single unit, solid and indivisible, able to execute his design for the children of men. So you see that the guardian says manifestation is not just someone who suddenly transformed and struck by the revelation and just opens a mouth and words come out. He works at this. Why? He's not an ordinary human being. They are not transformed into manifestations. This is critical, friends, that you understand this. Because if not, you will run into, or could very well run into, the same dilemma that Christians did when they made Christ God. You don't want to make the manifestations human. They aren't. Not ordinary human beings. For a time, they work through a human vehicle. Briefly, the holy manifestations have ever been and ever will be luminous realities. No change or variation takes place in their essence before declaring their mission. Before declaring their mission, they are silent and quiet like a sleeper. And after their manifestation, they speak and are illumined like one who is awake. And so, the function of this guidance then through the manifestations is sometimes compared to a mirror, a perfect mirror, through which the attributes of God can be made manifest to us. But I have heard sometimes used the analogy that we who are finite cannot stand to behold the infinite, and therefore we can't look up at God because he's too brilliant and bright and mind-boggling, but we can look at God through this perfect mirror. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? Because if it's a perfect mirror, it's just as blinding as the source of that perfect mirror. Right? So you've got to not mix the metaphors. The perfect mirror image is used, but it's in Abdu'l-Bahá's discussion of the distinction between manifestation and emanation. It might be better sometimes if in your teaching you use the image of the mirror to describe the fact that the most perfect image of God we get is through the manifestation. But one image I found very useful is the prism metaphor. And that is, this Holy Spirit is made understandable to us. The attributes visible to us through the manifestation. Now, one thing interesting about this, let me see how long have I been doing this? Too long? All right, we'll go a little longer. I don't want to bore you, but this is exciting stuff for me, needless to say. What's interesting about this metaphor, beside the fact that it's taking the pure white light that really is incomprehensible to us and giving it discernible attributes, is that the prism is infinite. And that is, you have here, with this red line, the visible aspects of the prism. Going in either direction, infinitely longer towards the left in this particular chart, or infinitely shorter towards gamma rays and X-rays and so forth to the right. Which means, the manifestation infinitely and perfectly reflects all the attributes of God. Stage three of assistance. He's helping us now. Well, we know that. But look at this. We've all read these before, but they take on another significance when you think of it in these stages. In my presence among you, there is a wisdom, and in my absence, there is yet another, inscrutable to all but God, the incomparable, the all-knowing. Verily, we behold you from our realm of glory and shall aid whosoever will arise for the triumph of our cause with the host of the concourse on high and a company of our favored angels. Another quote that's similarly astounding. Now, this is a longer version of a quote I gave you earlier, where the guardian talks about the fact that once released from this associative relationship with the figure that he chose to work through, the power of Baha'u'llah was unleashed and could, let me just read it. The dissolution of the tabernacle, wherein the soul of the manifestation of God had chosen temporarily to abide, signalized its release from the restrictions which an earthly life had of necessity imposed upon it. Its influence no longer circumscribed by any physical limitations, its radiance no longer be clouded by its human temple, that soul could henceforth energize the whole world to agree unapproached at any stage in the course of its existence on this planet. Okay, that's important to know. Well, this I'll skip over a bit, but this is something you all know because it's discussed fully in the Egon, namely that the closest we get to attaining the presence of God is attaining the proximity to the manifestation, which itself is not physical proximity, but spiritual proximity. But here's a part of it you may not have noticed. This persists in the next world. I remember I gave a talk and I was talking about this, and one Baha'i friend said, but it says we'll attain the presence of God in a form that befits, you know, what we've attained. And another Baha'i said, how can there be presence? There's no physical reality. So what does it mean? Well, what's interesting is this. We will have experience of God's spirit through his prophets in the next world, but God is too great for us to know without this intermediary. The prophets know God, but how is more than human souls can grasp. So in other words, this intermediary teaching device persists even in the next world. And so if we construct the causal relationships, beginning with the emanation from the first mind of the wish to be known, we get this. From the unknown essence of God emanates the primal wish or will of God by means of the Holy Spirit that conveys this wish to the pre-existent manifestation who determines to assume the guise of a human persona that he might exemplify godliness in his person and actions and provide laws and guidance for our creative action so we can progress in our love relationship with God. Now, I'm going to take just a few minutes and go through this quickly so that you can relax and so on. I'll be somewhere if you have questions. I don't know, Mehran, if what did we decide about that? Anyway, we'll figure that out later. Now we've done the collectivity of humankind, the intermediary relationship. Let's quickly look at the personal relationship. Three stages of the conscious self: prenatal, when we're in physical association relationship; post-associational clarity, we're in the world of vision. Stage one, before incarnation. That's a baby smiling in the womb. Why is it smiling? Well, because it doesn't have to go through all the stuff we go through every day, I guess. I don't know. But suffice it to say, and I have to say, Farid, that your dear wife, Farinak, at the course at Lou Helena taught, said, well, I think the baby has free will in the womb. And I thought, I never thought of that. You know, I don't remember my free will in the womb, but, you know, I know my son did a complete knot in his uterus, I mean, in the umbilicus. And the doctor, after he delivered James, said, you want this? Like it was an umbilical cord with a true knot in it, you know, not a kink, but a knot, you know. And I thought, you know, what is he, sick or something, you know? For one thing, that caused us to have about two stress tests to be sure he was getting enough blood because he had tied a knot in his umbilicus, so I wasn't pleased at all. Well, at any rate, we come up with this question, again, these crucial questions for which we have to, as Baha'i scholars, construct bridges to the answers. We know the answer. We know the answer, but unless we can convince others by constructing logical arguments, what good are we? The brain. 3 pounds of electrified meat are the repository of the conscious mind. It's an incredibly complex. It is the most complex thing in creation. And in my book, I go into a great deal of detail about brain theory and why, how the brain acts as the intermediary between our soul and our body. And so you get the brain made of 150 billions of these. I don't know why that got there. Now, why is this here? Hold on one second. Oh, okay. So we can construct a similar paradigm of a top-down view. We have the soul. We have the intermediary of the rational faculty, which emanates from the soul, and which during its associational relationship with the brain or through the brain to the body is relating to the body through the brain. But it's not dependent on the brain, you understand? As soon as the brain is rendered inadequate to become a functioning intermediary, the conscious mind is free to be in the world of vision, but it's still conscious. And so if you have transparency, as you did with the perfect mirror, then what you see...
Hello, I'm up a high.
...is what you get.
Hello, I'm up a high.
Now, that's if the brain is wired correctly, you don't have any emotional illnesses or physical illnesses, you're in good health. Basically, that's what we aim for, but it's never perfect. Now, if you don't feel like yourself sometimes, you get a distortion, a distorted image of what's happening in your soul. And so,
hello.
Or you...
I'm up a high.
You get... Now, this is if you get hit in the head hard or you just, you know, ate too much sugar or something. Now, this is the delusional self, where the brain is not transparent because of some chemical imbalance.
Hello, I'm up a high.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
That's my favorite. Let me tell you.
Right. Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
All right. Now, what we've got here is what I call in the book the periscopic view of reality. And this is kind of the end of where we're going with this. It's a simple metaphor, but I think it works very well. It means so long as this associative relationship endures, that you can affect the ability of yourself to understand yourself through some defect or malfunction in the brain. So not only is your ability to communicate with others encumbered, but your own ability to understand yourself is encumbered. But we know for a fact that the self, the essential self, the soul, is not affected. So, if you think of the brain as a milk carton taped together with an orange juice carton, and you've got a homemade periscope, then the soul, from the soul emanates the mind, the conscious self. But during this associational or associative relationship, it must deal with reality through that brain. In other words, you can't separate yourself unless you're having an out-of-body experience from this relationship. So the conscious mind is not really aware of the soul. It's only aware of itself. And so it may get information indirectly, inductively, through the senses. The information arrives in the conscious mind, you retain it, you decide what to do about it. Or you may be inspired, you may receive information directly from the realm of the spirit. All right, through prayer, through reflection, through meditation. It's still going to end up in the same place, in the conscious mind, so long as the brain is an associative relationship. So you're still not aware of the soul. So whether the information comes to you in a dream or through prayer, or through study of the writings, you still, it's in the same place, your conscious mind. And you still got to evaluate it and decide what you do with it, so long as you're in this associative relationship. As I said, this same process is happening right now with you and me. Finally, with a healthy brain, you have the powers of the soul, some of which are reason, will, self, self-consciousness, ideation, memory, emotion. Emotion is a product of the soul. It's transmitted through the chemistry of the brain, and you can make somebody happy by giving them a lot of endorphins. But, well, let's not get into that. Read the book. But that's a healthy brain and a healthy body. The Latin phrase, mens sana in corpore sano, transparency. But if things get screwed up, bad, then all of these capacities seem to disappear. Someone with Alzheimer's, someone with dementia, someone with a physical traumatic injury, they seem to disappear as personalities, as people we know. And so their own conscious self also disappears. And you'll get this report. It's sad, but it's true. From the Holy Body Shop. We can find absolutely nothing wrong with your soul or its powers and faculties. We can only conclude your temple has been totaled. Sorry, but as you know, we are not allowed to do reincarnations. And then stage three, where you're released from that associative relationship and you're in the world of vision. And all of these powers are now apparent again. In the twinkling of an eye, Baha'u'llah says this happens. As soon as that relationship severs, that happens. Right? We had some discussion at Lou Helen when I gave a course on this a couple of weeks ago of people relating experiences. Out-of-body experiences. So, very interesting. Well, this gives us a few additions, and this is the final paradigm. We go from the unknowable essence of God, so on, and we add to it the intermediary of the human brain, so long as the human soul is in an associative relationship with the human body. The hure of the veil between our consciousness and metaphysical reality during an associational period of existence. This is a lovely, lovely quote. Didst thou behold immortal sovereignty, thou wouldst strive to pass from this fleeting world. But to conceal the one from thee and to reveal the other is a mystery which none but the pure in heart can comprehend. And of course, you're all familiar, I know, with the story of the individual who asked Baha'u'llah for the boon of being able to see the next world. It's authenticated story. And Baha'u'llah said it wouldn't be good for you to do that. And he insisted, so Baha'u'llah said, okay, and showed him a glimpse of the next world, and he immediately killed himself. True story. Well, what is immortal sovereignty? All right, I'm sorry this is messing up here. That's immortal sovereignty. That's the Big Bang, from God's point of view. If there's one Big Bang, there's got to be a bunch of Big Bangs. We're looking at one Big Bang from inside it. Outside it, if you've got infinite space, there's other Big Bangs going on, right? There's probably glimpse of Big Bangs, you know. I've invented the glump in my book. I'll be famous someday for inventing the glump. And finally, in addition to the view of the cosmic celestial reality from God's point of view, we have the end of mortal sovereignty, which is not so impressive. Come on, computer, do your thing. Mon Dieu, qu'est-ce que c'est?
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Thank you.